What's up, guys? Saf here on Super Saf Speaks, and welcome to a very delayed episode number 29 of the podcast with myself, your host, Saf.
And Thunder E from Border Work. And by the way, this is our first episode of the year.
It actually isn't, because we did one right at the start of the year. Yeah, we did. This is how long it's been. This is how long it's been that he's actually forgotten that we've already had an episode. We have had one episode in 2022. But guys, look, no excuses. It's been busy. We've had lots of things going on YouTube, on social media, and everything else. So we just thought, well, to be fair, I'm going to give E the credit, because he has been pushing me to be like, dude, when are we doing the next podcast? There's so much stuff that we need to talk about. He's really been pushing. So yeah, shout out to Thunder for actually making this happen, because if it wasn't for him, I probably wouldn't have got back on here. But there's been a lot going on, some of which we want to talk about in today's podcast. So yeah, just to give you an overview, today we're going to be talking about the S22 Ultra. We both had it for 2 months. I've dropped my 2 month later review. So is E going to be dropping his very soon? But there's a problem with the S22 Ultra, which we want to address and talk about. We're going to be talking about Oppo's first in-house AP chipset, which could launch very early next year. The Vivo X Fold, which is the latest foldable on the market. Apple is now going to start beginning to manufacture the iPhone 13 in India. So that's a trend we're seeing a lot more, and there's lots we want to talk about. We're obviously going to talk about Elon Musk and Twitter, the whole situation there. Twitter possibly getting an edit button, something we've talked about on the podcast before, and I have a lot of thoughts on this as well, so we'll be discussing that too. So, firstly, E, how have you been, man?
Been good, man. Been good. It's been a minute. It's good to be back here with you guys, and you know, it's been busy and crazy. Like, it's one of those things where it should be slower now, and it kind of feels like it is, but there's so much stuff going on in the background.
This is the thing, though. Like, on the tech scene, like, you see, like, a lot of people, like, I haven't been uploading as often on the YouTube channel, but then what a lot of people don't see is the stuff that we have on in the background. Like, we're actually sorting out deals. Where, you know, I spent last week, I was supposed to be in San Francisco with Land Rover, and then I spent a day on an aeroplane, which didn't actually go anywhere. And then I came back home. You know, there's things like that that you don't really see going on in the background. And I just came back and I was just like, so I just spent a day at the airport and then sat on a plane for 6 hours and I'm back home. So I didn't go to the trip that I had scheduled and planned out. So there's been a lot of things that have been going on. We've obviously been working on a lot more social content as well. So, you know, even though you might not see it at the front, there is a lot of stuff going on in the background, right? And things can get like crazy busy. And then, you know, like, the podcast was unfortunately one of those things that we had to kind of like put to the side, and we're like, look, we'll get back into the flow of things. But hopefully we're going to be trying to do an episode like every couple of weeks. And yeah, we'll get back into the flow of things.
Yeah. We definitely will. But I think, you know, the topics we have today are a good way to kind of start off, especially looking at the Galaxy S22 Ultra, because, you know, I think this is a time where most people are looking past the hype and going, okay, what should we be concerned about?
So the S22 Ultra, we've been using it for the past couple of months, and overall, it's an excellent device, but we've not been just using one, we've been using two. Reason for that, as with every year, there are two separate versions of the S22 Ultra, which you will not know on the face of it. As far as you know, it's exactly the same device, but based on your region, you'll be either getting the version powered by the Qualcomm 8 Gen 1 chipset, or you'll be getting the one powered by the Exynos 2200. This is something that's been going on with Samsung Galaxy devices for many years now. You'll get some differences, you know, and a lot of it might just be down to logistics, because they sell so many S22 Ultras. It's also going to be down to costs, because obviously an in-house chipset is going to be much less. But for the consumer, that is a problem, right? Now, yes, you're not necessarily going to be side by side with somebody else that's got a different chipset, because they're different regions, right? But as we've discussed before, it's 2022. You're international, you're going to know through videos, through friends that are overseas, that you're getting performance differences. And I'd like to say this, though, E. they have been getting closer and closer, right? Because one of the things that I have noticed is battery life has actually been pretty consistent on both of them, roughly speaking. There's not been a significant difference. Usually the Qualcomm does edge out. But the two areas where I have seen differences, firstly, cameras, right? Because the chipsets come with their own ISPs, image signal processors, and they process images differently. So although the differences might just be kind of slight, there are differences there, right? And then more so, it's the differences in performance, especially when it comes to gaming. Now, E, you are a gamer. I am not, right? And you've actually done a detailed comparison between both the Exynos and the Qualcomm version. What have you noticed?
So it's interesting when you look at both devices because, you know, externally they look the same. Doesn't matter what color you pick, right? But when you boil down to gaming performance, they are sort of similar, which is a good thing. The problem you're going to be facing is not necessarily, you know, like take a game like Genshin Impact. Genshin Impact is one we all use. Granted, Genshin Impact is a poorly optimized game, so which is why it's difficult for, doesn't matter what chipset to run it, you know, pretty well. The Snapdragon performs slightly better, like maybe 3 or 4 frames better, which to me is not too crazy. The problem you face with this device is when you look at games like Call of Duty Mobile. Now, you might say, well, Call of Duty runs on anything. That is true. And to me, that's a good baseline because it should work, you know, at the same level everywhere. Call of Duty Mobile on the Snapdragon, what I got was Call of Duty Mobile, I ran it at the highest settings on Snapdragon, which is cool. And on the Exynos version, I could only run it on low to medium. Because developer had not gone around to, you know, optimizing for the chipset. So that's a problem I started seeing in a lot of games, PUBG, so on and so forth, where you're like, when will my games get optimized? You know, and there are a lot of games in the App Store.
This is the thing. Optimization is a key word here, right? We always talk about how iPhones are optimized for a lot of apps, and you hear people talking about that all the time. Now, as a developer, right, you're going to try to optimize what's going to get the maximum reach, okay? So when you've got a game or an app, you're like, okay, I want to optimize this for the iPhones, nice and easy. You've got one chipset across all the new iPhones. You've got a very similar resolution and things like that. So then you've got something to work against. Okay, I can tick that off. I can reach the maximum amount of devices. Now, when it comes to Qualcomm, the Qualcomm 8 Gen 1 is a chipset that's on many devices. We've got it on the OnePlus. We've got it on the Red Magic. We've got it on so many different Xiaomi phones and Oppo phones and all sorts, right? Now, if you're going to optimize a game, you're going to optimize it for the chip that's going to be on the maximum number of devices, understandably so. What that means is if you've got the Exynos version, yes, you will probably eventually get those optimizations for this chipset, but the issue is, when will that be? It's not going to be as soon as you're going to get it on the Qualcomm. And then the next time you get an update for a new app or a new game comes out, again, you're going to be going through the same situation.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's going to be an interesting problem down the line, just because with this chipset, I'm clearly seeing performance increases from last year. I mean, in terms of Exynos. So I wouldn't call it a bad chipset. I'm not saying it's terrible. I'm not saying that's the case. But my biggest problem I'm seeing is whenever I fire up another game and I'm like, okay, let me max out. It's not there. Okay. And then some people may argue, hey, you know, you don't have to max it out. You can play at different settings. And I'm like, it's fine if I paid for a phone that was $500, not a phone that is $1,200. I want the best from that $1,000 phone, not the $500 level.
Exactly. And that's a challenge as well, because, like, you know, as a consumer, you're not being told that you're getting a different chipset, right? You're picking up an S22 Ultra, thinking it's an S22 Ultra, the same one that's being sold everywhere, but it's not, right? And sure, the differences are getting more and more minor, but that is still an issue. Now, the other thing as well is, you know, some people in the past have imported smartphones over from overseas. So right now, I can just pop into Amazon, I can get the Qualcomm version, and I can get it imported into the UK. The issue, however, is when it comes to network networks and bands, right? So right now, the S22 Ultra that I have here, which is the Qualcomm 8 Gen 1 version, does not get 5G with Vodafone because the bands Vodafone in the UK that it uses are not supported because this phone is not meant to be used in the UK. It's meant to be used in the US, right? So that's another layer that you have to consider because you might be like, look, I really like this phone. I want to get it. I want the Qualcomm version. Let me import it over from the US. Oh, guess what? Now I can't get 5G, right? Now, apparently the Korean version will have the bands that will be supported here in the UK. But then it gets really complex. It's like, okay, look, can you just give me one smartphone? And this is one of the things that's easy with the iPhone, right? You buy the iPhone across the board. It's got the same, right? You've got the same performance, whether you're buying it in India, in the UK, in the US, in Hawaii, wherever you're buying it, it's going to have the same performance. And I think that's something that Samsung definitely needs to work on, making things consistent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, which is why I want to ask the next question is, you know, you're a camera guy. Mm. What have you noticed with the camera differences or similarities between both, you know, Exynos and Snapdragon?
So I think nowadays, because a lot of image processing comes down to the software, obviously Samsung is applying very similar software processing, which does make things somewhat consistent, but I'm still seeing differences in color, right? So I'm looking at skin tones and they are processed very differently on the Exynos versus the Qualcomm version. And that's something that I don't like because like if I'm doing a camera comparison, like it's very difficult for me to kind of portray what you're going to be getting because, hey, it might be slightly different if you're getting one version against the other, right? And that's, again, another issue that is something that you're not going to notice unless you put them side by side. And yes, I know Samsung has tried to make them as consistent as possible, but they're not the same. What about you?
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. I mean, in my case, it's taking a selfie, for instance, you know, there's more saturation on one and another one, I look lighter. Not like as bad as, you know, certain other manufacturers, but you can clearly see that I have two different skin tones, you know, between that. I think those are the kind of things that Samsung has to be very cognizant and careful about. Now, maybe part of the thinking is like, well, you know what, as long as we keep it close enough and they're going to different markets, it shouldn't matter. And theoretically, they're correct, right? It really shouldn't matter. But we live in a connected world, especially if, forget the comparisons, especially if you follow a creator on YouTube who kind of looks like you, has similar skin tone. So you're like, okay, look, let me, because with every camera has different, it functions differently with different skin tones, you know? So when I follow a creator that kind of looks like me and I'm like, okay, let's see what he thinks about the camera because he's taking pictures of himself and stuff like that. And then I see another creator, I'm going, wait a minute. But they kind of like, can you all talk to each other? Cause something's wrong here. It's different, you know?
Yep.
That's where it becomes, I think it becomes an issue. Now, the question is, what do you think they can do to solve that problem?
See, this is the thing. I would like consistency. Whether it's the Exynos across the board or whether it's the Qualcomm version across the board, I think it should still be the same. Or name them differently. And I've said this before, call it the S22 Ultra E. Or call it something different, right? Because I think it's unfair on the consumer because they're not getting to know what the difference is, right? As long as you know that I'm getting a different product. Now, it might be 95% the same, but if it's still different, it's different. And I think that's something that needs to be made clear if you can't have consistency across the board in terms of manufacturing, because that is the ideal situation.
Okay. I mean,
What do you think?
I have mixed ideas on this, and it kind of leads to our next topic once we'll get there. But I definitely agree with you. I think just either deciding what chipset to go with. On the one hand, we kind of we know that Qualcomm would love to have all of Samsung's business. They would love to supply all the chips, and we also know that there's an in-house team in Samsung that wants to own that business as well. So how about you guys just do a battle of the death? And just decide next year which, you know, which chip you want to go with. And then we will live with that chipset as long as you can provide it. Or maybe they do a hybrid like some other companies have. You know, we see Oppo that announced that they are doing, they announced this earlier last year that they were doing like a camera chip or something like that. Yeah. Maybe that's the case. I mean, I really don't know, but I prefer like the battle of the death scenario. Where they can pick something.
Yeah, but I mean, they should pick something. And, you know, it seems like Samsung is not going to be the only one that's doing this, because, you know, we've just, you mentioned Oppo, and we've just seen this report that as soon as next year, they'll be having their first in-house AP chip, right? So this might initially be on like sort of mid-tier smartphones, right? So it's the report says that the chipset will be produced on TSMC's 6-nanometer process, right? So it's not going to be the flagship chipset, but then it also starts a trend, right? Okay, if you're building a chipset in-house, financially, that makes great sense, because obviously you're going to cut on costs. You're not going to have to pay Qualcomm. You're going to make your own chipset. That makes sense from that side of things, but then there's that consistency element. Now, I think on mid-range smartphones, it matters less, because as we were saying earlier on, right, that if you're spending flagship money, you're spending £1,200 or $1,200, you expect a certain level, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's important. I think on the mid-range, it's not as significant, personally.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's not that significant, but I'm actually thinking why they are actually doing this, because on the mid-range side of things, we've seen a big growth from Qualcomm's biggest competitor, MediaTek. Mm-hmm. Over the last couple of years, where they've kind of solidified that mid-range with their cheaper pricing and more versatile line of chipsets there. With Oppo making a 6-nanometer chipset, I'm still trying to figure out why, unless they're looking at other products. One of the biggest things we always forget with making chips of your own is you have to fall into basically one of three categories, right? A Qualcomm or MediaTek is the number one category, where you're making it for as many customers as possible, and that's just your core business. Two, you have enough money to burn to go through those chipsets. And there are three companies that fall into that category. Apple is one, and they've made their own chipset from that. Microsoft is the other. You know, they made the specialized one for the Surface, but they have enough money. Even if it doesn't work, it doesn't, you know, for them, it doesn't matter. And Google is the other one with the Tensor chipset. Mm-hmm. Now, the third category is where you're looking to build hybrid chips just to supplement certain things, which Oppo kind of started off with. So my question is, this 6-nanometer chipset, how much money are they going to spend to it? Or are they just technically doing a fourth category, taking a MediaTek or a Qualcomm-based chip and just modifying it a little bit and then calling it their own in-house? You know, that could be the case there.
Potentially. And that's something that we've just got the Red Magic 7 Pro in the house. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm aware, they're doing something to that effect, aren't they?
Yes, they call it their own gaming chip. And honestly, I reached out to them and they didn't give me any specifics on what it does. So I don't know what it brings to the table to take that, like, you know, like take the gaming to the next level or ensure. It performs well. Like, it performs really well. So that is fine. But, you know, I'm sure they're doing something with that chipset. But that's an avenue that I think is interesting, because they are going like, hey, we're a gaming company, so let's do something to make sure gameplay is, like, you know, super solid, you know? So
okay. All right. I don't know. Currently that just sounds like marketing to me. It doesn't seem like there's anything too tangible from what you're saying, if they didn't give you any specifics.
But, no specifics.
Hey, we'll see. We'll see. All right. That's the whole chip situation. Let's now move on to some new hardware.
Before we do that, quickly, somebody else said they were making a chip.
Who's that?
Samsung.
Another chip.
There was reports came out that Samsung might be doing a fully dedicated Galaxy line chip for next year. Speculation started breaking out whether we're going to move, like you just mentioned earlier, fully to Exynos, or it's a new chipset altogether that is an improved version of what Exynos should be. Now, my own question here for you, because I already know where I'm going to stand, is do you think this is a wise move for Samsung?
See, the Exynos chip is fine overall, and it has been really good, generally speaking. But for me, it's that consistency. I think from a business perspective, it makes sense, right? Because once you've got your own in-house chip, you're saving a bunch of money, right? Which you can either pass down to the consumer by lowering the price of the device, or, you know, you can invest on more R&D and making that chip even better, right? So I think from a business perspective, it makes sense, right? Because anything that you buy third party is going to cost you more, right? You have complete control over it. And one of the things that I used to see before as well is that Exynos devices used to always get updates, software updates, before the Qualcomm devices, right? And one of the reasons for that was it's their own chipset. It's just easier that way. So I think from a company point of view, it makes sense. For the consumer, I think it shouldn't make that much of a difference as long as it's competitive. What about you?
I think they should actually create their own chipset, but with Qualcomm, not an Exynos chip. I think this is where they can actually take their buying power as being Samsung and go to Qualcomm and say, hey, look, it's still going to be a Snapdragon whatever, but this team is going to specialize it for the next Galaxy. Okay. And this is what we need from it. Because I think that's where you get the ease of, for people like me, the gaming, so you don't have those issues with software, even other apps too, just probably apps in general, like, you know, being optimized and things like that. And then you still will get the best of both worlds where Qualcomm now starts learning, okay, maybe we shouldn't be doing this stuff because that actually works out better, you know, in the first place. So
you're saying a much deeper collaboration where it's actually something a bit more custom specifically for Samsung.
Yeah, I think so. I think just being Samsung and being the largest, you know, buyer of chips from Qualcomm, you can go in and create that relationship and say, hey, look, I need this thing to be stellar. We're trying to beat Apple, so this is what we need from you, you know?
All right, let's see. Let's see if that happens. Qualcomm, if you're listening, Samsung, if you're listening, it's time to collaborate. Me and E are happy to be on the board to make sure, oversee everything goes... Well, but anyway, all right. So the next foldable on the market, well, not in the international market anyway, the Vivo X Fold, right? So this looks pretty promising. It's the front display is wider, something that I do prefer, and I'm hoping that the Fold 4 will have, the Galaxy Fold 4, powered by Qualcomm's 8 Gen 1 processor. So that's the first foldable that's powered by the 8 Gen 1, right? It's it can survive apparently 300,000 volts. So if you're opening and closing the device 80 times a day, it's going to last you around 10 years of daily usage, which you won't be using anyway for that long. So that's pretty durable. It is quite... It's quite heavy, 311 grams compared to, you know, the Huawei and the Samsungs, which are on 270 to 290 grams. You do have, an interesting camera setup. You've got 8 megapixel, 5x optical zoom. You've got a 50 megapixel primary camera, a 48 megapixel ultra wide, as well as a 12 megapixel portrait camera. So there's like a quad camera setup going on here. And you also have fingerprints both on the outside and on the inside. So that's under display fingerprint scanners on the outside and the inside. Now, this is going to be retailing for around 9,000 yuan, which is approximately converted around $14,000. But it seems like for now anyway, it's just going to be China exclusive.
$1,400. You said $14,000. I was like, whew.
Sorry, $1,400. $1,400. But this is the thing, right? Okay, so it's in China, which is good. But the problem is, I'm seeing this trend, which I'm not personally liking right now, where a lot of devices are coming out in China first. Then we get them imported in, right? We do the coverage, and then they're like, hey, would you like to check out our brand new device? I'm like, the brand new device, which I covered 2 months ago because I just imported it in, and it's 2022, and, you know, the world is international. So that's my problem, because I'd love to check this out. You know, me and you love foldables, so I might try to get it imported in. But as far as I can see right now, it is just going to be in China.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a solid device. I mean, besides the weight, but I do like that. I do like the fact that, look, honestly, foldables have come to stay, and people have realized that this is a very different segment of the smartphone market. So now we're seeing competition from everyone for Samsung's crown, which makes, you know, which means Samsung has to improve itself. So which is also good on its own. But on the merits of the device and being able to get it on time, hey, like you said, this is every other company in the past used to do international launches. Doesn't matter where they did the launch in terms of location, it was always international. It's like it will be available in these markets, right? Now for Vivo, and I know Vivo as a company is trying to push up as being one of the top tier, you know, Android phone manufacturers out there. I think it's very important to at least being able to showcase these devices out there, because this thing looks solid. Like I like the width, you know, I like the height also. It's not as short as the Oppo. And, you know, it looks like something where I even like the fact that it's got dual fingerprint sensors. I mean, I don't think it's needed, but I like the fact that, you know, even if you had it open, you were just laying it flat and your screen turned off, you didn't have to use just one other fingerprint sensor. You can just, you know, turn it on. Plus, you know, it looks like at least they're giving their best camera arrays on there. I don't know what Vivo currently uses as their best cameras, but a 50 megapixel sensor, 48, you're getting at least current stuff, right? Which hopefully, you know, it turns out well. Plus, that price is not bad at $1,400.
Yeah, I mean, it's converted, but it's not bad at $1,400. And I think that's a good point. Like right now with the Folds, you are having to make a few compromises because you're not getting the ultra-level cameras. For example, the camera hardware is a couple of years old, for instance. So there are a few of these things which I think will hopefully now more competition in the market will push Samsung, who is currently leading because, hey, that's the kind of go-to, and they're the ones who are really at the forefront of foldables. But now with all of these new devices coming up, it puts pressure on Samsung to really up the game, and that's something that I'm personally quite excited about.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think we're going to see next year is going to be a very interesting year with foldables, because I think that's the true year we get that price drop. And then everything just starts falling. This year, we're going to get like the tempting price drop, I think, where you're like, again, like this price where it's $1,400, right?
Yeah.
And we're like, it's not bad. So
yeah.
I think we'll see that in the next couple of years.
Exciting times ahead. Okay, let's talk about Apple and India. So India, as we know, is a huge, huge market. It's one of the fastest growing markets when it comes to smartphones. It's, however, an area which Apple hasn't really been able to capitalize on, right? Because if you look at market shares, Android devices overwhelmingly dominate the Indian market, right? Because it's a very different market in terms of budgets, right? So if you've got, like, if previously it was the OnePlus, which was like the number one flagship device, but mid-range devices do really well. But the other issue that Apple has always had is that India has very high import fees, right? And duties. So we hear our followers talk about this all the time, that anything that we can buy here, it's going to cost so much more in India. And if you've ever sent a device from the UK or US to India, which we have them previously, the import fees are just insane. Now, from India's point of view, it's understandable, because what they want to do is they want to encourage in-house production, right? They want to create more jobs. They want to, you know, they want to boost their own economy rather than just getting, and they know, they're aware of the fact that they are a very big and also a growing market. So it looks like Apple is going to start manufacturing iPhone 13s in India. And what that should do is that should bring the price down, right, of the iPhone 13 in India, and possibly increase Apple's market share there. Now, this is a step, and it seems like another reason why Apple are doing this is to kind of, you know, not have all of their manufacturing just in China, because then there's a heavy reliance on that area. So this way they are also diversifying, which obviously makes sense. But I think this is a trend that we're going to see more and more of as the years go on, because again, with that massive market that you've got over 1 billion people in India, right, a lot are first-time smartphone users. They're going to be upgrading. They might have started off on a very basic Android smartphone. Now they want, you know, they want some better cameras. You've got such a huge market there, and the way to tap into that market is by manufacturing within India itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a smart business move, especially when you look at certain markets. You know, India is one of those markets where, just on a, you know, logistical side of things, why aren't you producing in India? Just forget whether you're even selling there or not, because there's a large population. You've got a very good pool of people who are technically savvy as well to jump into production. So those things are there on that aspect. I think, into getting into the market, you're right, it brings the prices lower from an import price. I don't know how much it would affect in-country prices. So will it be the same price as it is, you know, we have in the US or the UK? I mean, well, US actually, because UK sometimes is either lower or cheaper depending on how taxes run. But will it be similar pricing, or would it be cheaper? Because one of the things also, again, with markets like that is that because you've got a large population, it's a growing economy, you do have a lot of people who, in terms of budgets, are not willing to spend as much as that, like a $1,000 phone. Right. Mm. So, of course, you want something in that, you know, mid-range price point. So those things come into play. Maybe this is where Apple looks at, you know, slightly older models, like last year's model of like the iPhone 12s or something like that, where, of course, those prices can be lower, or, you know, whatever they decide to play with. But I think, you know, this makes sense for a lot of them. And then you look at it from the other aspect is that, you know, Apple, like you mentioned, is moving their reliance on China. So their same article talked about moving the AirPods factory to Vietnam and then moving to other places around to, you know, and again, it makes sense because you don't want all your eggs in one basket, right? Mm. Yeah. You know, and now pandemic hits and, you know, your production isn't slowed down just because China, which is the world's manufacturing hub, isn't shut down.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think from a business perspective, it totally makes sense. And as I said, I think this is a trend we're going to start seeing more and more of, especially with how much supply issues have been affected over the past couple of years. More and more manufacturers are going to start diversifying and making sure that they've got manufacturing coming from lots of different places. So, you know, it's not fully affected if there is supply issues, pandemics, or whatever else going forward. So an interesting space right now. All right, let's talk about Twitter, shall we? E, I know you've got lots of thoughts about this. So unless you've been sleeping for the past 2 weeks, you may have noticed that Elon Musk is now the largest shareholder of Twitter. And there was talks about him coming on to the board of directors. And this is something that the current CEO of Twitter talked about, Parag Agarwal. And a couple of days ago, it was announced that actually, no, they've decided that he's not going to be joining the board of directors, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is, so some people are saying that the reason for this is if he did join the board, then that would have restricted his purchases to 14.9%, right, of common stock. But now that he's not joining, he can do more. The other side of it is that he likes to troll, and he's been saying lots of really random things on Twitter. And obviously, as somebody that's on part of the board of directors, that's going to not be great for them. So that might have been another thing there as well. But E, I'm going to let you talk about this a little bit because I know you've got some strong feelings.
Look, I'll put it out there. I'm not the biggest Elon Musk fan at all. But I think this kind of plays back to him putting up that tweet saying there should be a new social network. He was talking about, he put out a tweet, just paraphrasing. And to me, I think it's Elon doing what Elon does best. He trolls everyone. He's used Twitter as his the best marketing engine possible. Like, look at it from all scenarios. Now, everybody has a different standpoint. There's so many. One of them, of course, is the fact that Tesla does not run a single set of TV ads. They will have ads on, they have Google ads that will show up whenever you search, like search ads and things like that. But there are no TV ads. There are no like sponsored ads. They don't do anything necessarily sponsored with creators or anything like that. Or what they do is they use Elon as the number one hype machine to push things off. So he, having that platform secured more to his liking, again, makes sense from that standpoint. Now, when it comes to him not being on the board, I think he found out, he thought about it, and it's like, yeah, it's logical for not me not being on the board for two reasons. One, if I wanted to buy more, I'm stuck at 14.9%. But again, he can't have majority say. I think there's still a cap for any single individual to own. So I'm not exactly sure what that cap is, but he can still buy more than that. But more importantly, if he's on the board, he has to watch what he says, especially as a massive shareholder. It's something that he's going to get in a lot of trouble with the SEC with this. So I think it was just best for him to go away from that and not talk about that, because now he's now in a position to swing the share price and value of two major companies. Mm-hmm. No longer one. He's been doing this with Tesla. He's made Tesla, I don't know if Tesla is a $1 trillion company yet, but the valuation of Tesla is ridiculous. It should not be where it is. For full disclosure, I own Tesla stock. But I will tell you that there is nothing that fundamentally says Tesla stock should be where it is right now, but it is. So I take it that, look, he just looks at it and goes like, yeah, it makes more sense for me to not be on the board because I would have to keep things at a certain level, especially on the same platform. If I'm on the platform, on the board and talking, it's worse than just being the CEO of Tesla talking on Twitter. That's the difference there.
And I think it also makes sense for Twitter themselves because, you know, then you're dealing with a whole different set of issues. Now, personally speaking, I know how you feel about Elon Musk. I think for me, it's just, I just find it entertaining because seeing some of his tweets and some of the responses that you get through and stuff, he's a master troll, as you mentioned. And that's something that I personally find entertaining, right? Just kind of logging onto Twitter and just seeing some of the tweets and some of the responses and stuff. And he's, you know, when we talk about the term influencer, right? That is probably, he's probably one of the biggest influencers in the world right now because he can massively influence not only stock prices and share prices, but also like things like opinions and all sorts. And it's just one tweet, boom, right? And it's just got such a big impact on so many different things. I remember like anytime he's responded to me on Twitter, just blows up, right? I just get so many, like, I remember when the Cybertruck, and I asked him if we could make a black Cybertruck, and he was like, yeah, sure. Articles everywhere, this, that. It's just crazy, right? And that's just the amount of impact that as one individual you can have, which is kind of insane. And one thing that I do like, I got to say this, right? From a CEO perspective, I like how active he is on social media, right? Because a lot of other CEOs, they'll have, like, they'll tweet once a month or once a week, right? And you can see that whatever they've tweeted has been vetted by 15 different people and stuff like that, right? It's not very personal, okay? What I like about Elon Musk is there's no filter. You're kind of seeing him directly and he is very engaged on that.
I mean, yeah, I can see that. But my counter argument to that will always be the reason why he does that is because his wealth is tied to the share value of Tesla. So the more he hypes it up, talks about it, gives you claims, makes the most sense. Other CEOs are not like him. None of them own as much of their company's stock. Even Jeff Bezos, who owns a lot of Amazon, still doesn't own as much as he does in terms of just the value of it. Because here's the thing, and we keep forgetting this, is like I look at him, he's trying to become the first trillionaire. Because once, you know, Tesla has such a high value, he's invested in other companies. Once SpaceX becomes public, game over, done. You know, that's the trifecta. And I see the path he's taking. And look, it's fine. That, don't get me wrong. I just go, look, as a Tesla stockholder, please fix the panel caps in your vehicles. Just make them sturdier. Like I'm like, give people better product. Even though I don't think I'll ever own a Tesla. I'll put it out there publicly. I highly doubt I will own one. But you know,
I mean, he's speaking to a Tesla owner here. But my point is, I know he's unconventional, but I think that's what gives him the appeal, right? Because look, us guys, right? One of the things I think why, you know, I don't make the best videos on YouTube. You know, I'll say that. But I think
I do. Right.
Yeah. Arguable. JK.
You should see his face. You should see Saf's face. He's like,
disgust. No, but he makes great videos. My point is that I think one of the reasons why my audience resonates with me is because I'm just myself. There's no filter. I just chat whatever I want on Twitter. I'll make crazy thumbnails and all sorts, right? And I think that's something that people can relate to, because when you've got this, you know, when you've got this filter of somebody who's, because you've got other YouTubers who are not very engaged on social media, right? And they kind of feel almost disconnected, right? And this is why I think Twitter is a great place, because you can have these conversations. I can reply to people. I can talk to people quite openly. And, you know, everybody else in our sort of community does the same, right? And that makes things a lot more relatable. And I think on a level that Elon Musk is, you know, if he can just be conversating with people, you know, like regular people, that gives such a different impression of a person than anybody else in that sort of space, in my opinion. And I think that's what kind of makes him somewhat unique in that sense, right? That he's very unfiltered. He posts memes all the time. It just makes people kind of relate to him a little bit more, that, you know what, he's just a cool, chill guy. You know what I mean?
No, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I just say there's always a motive behind every action. So the action is correct.
Every action has an equal reaction. Where's that from again?
Every action has a, I can't remember what it was, has an equal reaction. But yeah, I do agree with you. I just think that every action has its own motives involved.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's all. But while we're on the topic of Twitter, we have to talk about this, because we've talked about it before, the Twitter edit button, right? This is something that's been talked about for many, many years. And then Elon Musk talks about this. He does a poll about editing tweets. And then suddenly Twitter actually, you know, addresses that they're going to be having an edit button. They're working an edit button. And the Twitter official comms account says, now that everyone's asking, yes, we've been working on an edit feature since last year. No, we didn't get the idea from a poll. So they're just making that clear. We're kicking off testing within Twitter Blue Labs in the coming months to learn what works, what doesn't, and what's possible, right? Now, the VP of Consumer Products, Jay Sullivan, has said that the edit button has been the most requested Twitter feature for many years. People want to be able to fix sometimes embarrassing mistakes, typos, and hot takes in the moment. They currently work around this by deleting a tweet and again, which is just silly. He didn't say that. Sorry, I'm just adding that, my own commentary there. Without things like time limits, controls, and transparency about what has been edited, edit could be misused to alter the record of the public conversation. Protecting the integrity of that public conversation is our top priority when we approach this work. Okay, here's my point with this, right? There's a lot of fluff that they're talking about. I'm telling you exactly what it's going to be. The edit button is going to be there. You're going to be able to edit. There might be a time limit of you know, maybe a few seconds, maybe 30 seconds, where you're like, oh, I've made a mistake. I can go ahead and edit this. And then there's going to be a history. There's going to be a little tab where you're going to be able to see the history of those tweets. So you're going to be see if somebody's completely changed something, right? We've already had this on Facebook, right? For years, you can edit a caption or a post on Facebook, and then there's a little history tab, and it will show you what you had previously. Okay, it's a very, very simple thing, and it should have been done a long time ago. But they're still doing this, and I'm telling you right now, you can quote me on this. It's going to be a very similar format of that, because that's all it can be. They're not going to do anything revolutionary. If they're not going to do anything revolutionary, why is it taking so long? Just get it done. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you why. I agree with you. I think the process is going to be that, but I actually don't think it's going to be a time limit. I think it's going to be, you can just edit your thing once. Whatever you want to edit, you can edit it, but there will be a history tab to it. I think the problem is their code. And I think that is why it's taking this long, especially when the uproar was high enough for people to go like, we need to edit this. Just the reason I'm only saying this is that I saw the initial integration of Twitter Spaces into the platform, and it was so bad. Yeah, and even when they did this with Periscope, we know when you could use Periscope, kinda that also had been very, very bad. There is something with their underlying code that makes it harder to do an edit, because the other options are attached. So it's just, you just have to create a pathway over to do an edit within that code. So you go into that history or whatever their data log is. I think that's just the biggest problem they face, which is why they haven't done it.
It's not impossible, and you know, it's a big company. It's doable. That's my point, right?
Oh no.
And we've
I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah, we've already had the ideas in place, right? Everybody's like, look, I get it from the perspective that you might put something out there, and you know, you might change completely what it says later on. That's obviously not cool, which is why you're gonna have to have some of these precautions in place, which is understandable. But we've talked about these solutions for ages. You already pretty much know what's going to work. Test it out, put it out there, stop faffing about. Like, come on, it's been too long since we've not had an edit button. Yes, people are going to misuse it. And when they do, maybe have like a system where, okay, you get a 3-strike rule, right? If you misuse it to an extent where it's blatant misuse, where you're completely changing what you're doing, then you lose the ability to edit. You know what I mean? It's not impossible.
No, I don't disagree with you. I really don't think it's any of those. I really think it boils down to, now, a lot of people will not remember this. About 7 years ago, Facebook changed their underlying code of what Facebook is today. And that's why Facebook is so smooth at syncing everything, even stuff they buy externally. This was about 7 years ago. That was the same time. Remember when Zuckerberg said, we are moving, Facebook is more of a mobile connection. That was when they went in and they literally changed it. I blame Jack Dorsey for not looking at it the same way and spending just that time to take the underlying layer of Twitter. Because when I look at Twitter, I look at it and I go, it should be much more. But it feels like it's stuck. It just really, I mean, everything you said is absolutely valid, because all the things it needs to do, especially with edit button, like, it's not that hard. But this, to me, it just feels like there's an underlying layer that they are literally going like this in the office, scratching their heads and going like, how do we do this properly? So,
well, it'll be good to finally have it whenever it does come, because it's been a long time coming. And I think, as I said, I'm pretty sure it's going to be in that format where, you know, which we've already seen versions of on the likes of Facebook. And it's, you know, from a UI perspective and like from a usability perspective, it's not difficult. Obviously, whatever they need to do in the background, it's not our problem, it's their problem. We want solutions. We demand solutions. But hopefully that'll be coming soon. And yeah, we'll be sure to test that out. I'm not on Twitter Blue right now, but I don't know if I can be on it. But anyway, I will go on it just to test it out when it does come.
Yeah, isn't Twitter Blue $3 a month, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we talked about it in the podcast some time ago, but then when we kind of saw what was on offer, we were like, yeah, it's not really worth it.
Yeah, so, I mean, if they had thrown the edit feature in Twitter Blue, I would have paid for it.
I mean, maybe that's what
especially,
they
especially me.
Yeah, with you and your typos. Oh, God. But the thing is, maybe that's what it is. Maybe they will have the edit feature, but only if you're on Twitter Blue, because that's a massive revenue generator.
Oh, yeah. As long as you don't limit me to 100 edits.
Because he'll be editing away. He'll be making mistakes upon mistakes. But okay, maybe that's what they're going to do. If that's the case, then fair dues. I'm more than happy to pay that for the ability to edit my tweets. So yeah, maybe it's going to be something that, yeah, you have to pay for. It's like, hey, okay, yeah, cool. We've got the edit feature. But hey, $3 a month. And then once you've got a few million people signed up, boom.
Maybe then you pay $10 more if you want to hide edit history.
Yeah. have all the tears. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Oh, man. But anyway, guys, that's all we have time for today. Once again, want to apologize that it took us so long to get this episode online. There's been a few people asking. Really appreciate. We see those comments. We see those tweets. Please do get involved. Let us know what you want us to talk about in the next episode on Twitter. We are at SuperSaf Speaks, as well as on Instagram. And hopefully we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening. This is Saf on SuperSaf Speaks with my co-host,
Thunder E from Border Work.
And we'll see you next time.